Confusion matrix.
Okay, well, welcome back. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm very well. How are you, Pete?
Yes, good. On this sunny spring day.
Oh, it's glorious. I went for a walk. It was nice.
And I think some people are calling it Liberation Day, but less said about that, the better.
Yeah, we'll probably have to come back to that at some point, but I'm ignoring it for the moment.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so let's ignore that. And we wanted to talk about knowledge bases, and I guess really the new breed of knowledge base spawned by our favourite friend, large language models. So we've been doing some work recently on them, and I think that you're kind of fairly active on one at the moment. So we'll probably get into the weeds a bit, but I guess I was thinking we should probably start with a quick overview for what we mean here by a knowledge base and the sort of an outside in view. So as someone that wanted to use one, why might it be useful? What would you use it for? And then I'm sure we'll get into a little bit more about what we throw into them and how we get it to work, and then some of the good, bad and ugly of them. With that in mind, what do you mean by knowledge base at the moment?
Well, so you could have a database. It, in my mind, is it's usually structured or semi-structured. Is usually made to be queryable via a specific structure, and sits on a specific piece of software or software architecture or paradigm. So a relational database, things in tables that are joined together, document database is sort of JSON-ish, and graphs, databases, whatever. And all of these can be used as a knowledge base. Mm-hmm. And I guess you would argue that that's what they are by nature, but not what we're talking about here. So you've got a master data records database for your customer, records, sure. But it's a different thing. It's highly structured, very closely managed in terms of keeping the data integrity and maintaining accurate records, right?
Yeah.
That's absolutely not what we're talking about here. what I mean, is a very, very loosely structured set of documents, which could be Word documents, PowerPoints, Excels, PDFs, Markdown, blah, 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 and may have some structure, some metadata structure, some uniform use of things like headers or whatever, but ultimately is about text-based free-form data and probably some structured and semi-structured. And for the purposes of sort of storing knowledge, right, as in almost like, for want of a better term, intellectual knowledge, right? So you are a historian researching the Norman conquests, and you might have a knowledge base where you keep all your notes, all your references, pointers towards web pages, text web pages, Wikipedia entries, all of this stuff. And so when you want to know about Battle of Hastings, right, you can go and find it. It's probably in a folder structure, right?
Yeah.
So you go into your knowledge base, you go Norman Conquest, Battle of Hastings, and you might have a folder for, the people involved or something, right? And then a bunch of documents of some sort, or references, or research, or notes, or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So far, so fairly boring, right? But, and I think this is not a new concept.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you would argue that most company sort of file structures like SharePoint are essentially probably a slightly chaotic version of this. And a product like SharePoint is a solution to some of the problems inherent in that type of data store, certainly by way of attaching, for example, metadata to documents and so on. But I'm sure you could name a bunch of others, things like Confluence, Notion, any number of wikis. I guess Wikipedia is one, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it drills down to the sort of individual level where you start getting things like Evernote, even on Apple and on iPhone and Samsung stuff, Android, where you can just make notes really easily. You've got a little scratch pad. And then the issue is, how do I store that? It's automatically saved under notes, but you want to relate that to some documents, and if you look at the Apple ecosystem, they're making everything easier to, now I can go on with my Apple Pencil and highlight something and then point it to a document, this sort of stuff, and automatically cut and paste it in. There are whole swathes of people on the web who talk about how they manage their Evernotes, how they take bookmarks from the web, put them into Evernote, manage their Evernote in some other way. There are tools to manage really different notes. So this is quite, as you say, it's an old problem of which there are a multitude of different solutions, some very personalized and individualized, some, with big tools given by corporations. And I sort of feel like every few years, each generation would probably get slightly better. And then the thing about these things is 5 years later, they always seem to rust pretty badly. And everyone starts off with, oh, look, he's got this new tool, new way of storing notes. I've got a new idea in my head of how to do it. And I start doing it that way. And that's great for four notes. It's great for 10 documents. When you've been doing it 5 years and your sort of pattern of behavior's changed a bit and the things you're looking at changed. And then you go back and go, oh, yeah, I was looking at that a couple of years ago. Where are my notes on that? And then you're like, oh, yes, when I was doing it slightly different. And then you're into that whole, like, I know I've got the knowledge somewhere, but access is now a bit of an issue.
Yeah, I think a lot of people who find themselves in that at that end point often resort to just throwing it all away, right? You basically end up with like a few folders that you go, yeah, well, these are the bits places where I keep the important stuff. So I'll move those over. And then everything else, control A, delete, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, that's a natural consequence of any type of data store. I mean, you would argue the same thing about a relational database in certain circumstances. You've got to keep your data fresh. And then you've got the issue of versioning, redundant or completely copied data. I've got this Word document in four places because I was working on this project and I had it over there, so I cut and paste, blah, 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 cut and pasted it there. And there's a whole bunch of sort of waste in there. And it's just like when your house is just, your room has got so cluttered, you just don't know where to start,
yeah.
Right? It's just a big old mess. And you've got to find, the hairdryer. Well, I haven't. But like some people might, it could be anywhere, right? Where do I even start looking for it? And then end up, you go on Amazon and buy a new air dryer rather than look for it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the one of the key things there is there's a storing aspect and a retrieval aspect. And quite often the two influence each other, because when you're storing it away, and hence the folder structure, you've got to file something away. Where do I file it? Well, I want this to be useful for the future. Right, let's create a file structure. What am I going to remember? Boom, bang, bang. They got your hierarchy. It's a very traditional way to do it. Other ways, let's use tags, which are great when you're working on that project and all those acronyms are in your head. And then you look for a tag of CNN and PwC and, great. And then 2 years later, you can't remember any of those because you've moved on, and then you go, all right, well, what are all these acronyms in my folders? And so you get at both sides. You create a structure to store it, think about how you're going to access it, and then your access, which could be immediate or sometime down the line, is then influenced very much, and then you overlay search, and again, there's another generation that arrived there, which is, oh, we can just bug a Google search on everything. and that was great. But I've, as I'm sure you've experienced, inside a company, quite often knowledge bases get thrust into things like HR because people are always asking them questions, you know, about this. And you get a global company with their HR documents, you know, some of which are very official for all countries. And then you do a search on something like, you know, oh, employment rights in this situation, and you get 422 hits back, which of course is greatly reduced from the 25,000 documents in their database. But it's no good to use a user when you kind of don't know what you're looking for, and they've got 422 documents to scan, and you're like, yeah, I'm not looking through that. So, you know, you layer on search allows people to make a bigger knowledge base, still makes it useless for the user.
SEO exists wherever you've got a search, right? Search engine optimization is a thing.
Yeah.
Wherever you've got search and enough documents to, you know, to make search, you know, a worthy addition. One of my prior contracts, and we're going back, well over a decade now, was at Network Rail, and my entire job, and so that's a big British infrastructure, rail infrastructure organization that was sprouted off from British Rail back in the olden days. So big sort of civil service like organization with rules and regs and all sorts of documentation, safety, and then all the sort of project rollouts and rolling stock and all this stuff. So they were really document heavy. And my whole job was to optimize the search function on their intranet, right?
Yeah.
So I did SEO for an intranet, and it was incredibly boring. And I can't remember the name of the product we were using. It later got assimilated into SharePoint, bought by Microsoft and assimilated into SharePoint. And it was not, it wasn't bad, but there was only so far you could go with it, right?
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's the same problem. If you get a search results, you've got the first 10, and if you don't find what you're looking for in that, then you give up. And actually, it's quite, even with a modest amount of documents, it's really hard to do properly. And I quit out of that contract because it was miserable. God knows if they carried it on, but it was a bit of a quixotic task, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely. So where are you, you know, where are you landing more recently? What's the sort of stuff you're getting into in as you work on stuff at the moment?
Well, I mean, this goes back to the stuff you and me have been doing for a good year now. I think we have knowledge. I accumulate stuff. So I've got quite a few different knowledge bases. I've got my other podcasts, one of them's very much arts based, Art Against Mental Illness. If anyone wants to go and listen to that, I accumulate stuff for research, and I've got all my prior episodes and so on. We've got our business knowledge base, and we, a while ago, set up once we sort of understood some of the capabilities of the language models, when we had a bit of time on our hands, we were recording us just talking about what we've done, what we've done, case studies, our thoughts on things. And, you know, at that point, half of mine was maybe we should have a podcast, but the main reason we were doing it was so we can capture this stuff, because we're bloody terrible at writing it down and bloody terrible at making notes. So we thought, well, let's just record it, transcribe it and keep it, and then we'll figure out what the hell to do with it. Well, of course, we accumulated many, many megabytes of this. And then we're like, well, what do we do with this now, right? And so the language models, well, the obvious answer to that, but to get into why and how gets a little bit more complicated. But I think it's a natural progression from folder structure, tag, search, and various other similar things into natural language queries, which is what a search engine is really.
Yeah.
Right. It's just a very rudimentary way of doing natural language queries. And some of the available search engines, open source search engines like Solr, have been around for a long time, decades, I would guess, and have sort of good semantic engines and have had for quite some time. Elasticsearch is another one. And we're doing, providing capability for much more intelligent and intuitive search for anyone. And that's been around for quite a while. One or both of those is mutating into a more AI-based, LLM-based software. But I think, you know, I've been using Obsidian for a while, which is a bit of a nerdy metadata store, a bit like a wiki, like Confluence, but it's a bit more flexible and it's got a really amazing open source ecosystem of apps that you can plug into it for free. And so after noodling around with Notion for a bit, which was costing us money that we didn't have and wasn't really floating our boat, we settled on Obsidian because I like it. And then that's where all our content's been going, in the Obsidian. So that's, I mean, it's worth mentioning that, you know, with any of these solutions to the findability problem, you're always going to put stuff in folders, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I think there possibly has been a view at some point that, why do I need folders when I've got search, right?
Yeah.
Why do I need folders when I've got tags? And the reality is, you're going to get into lots of trouble really quickly. Your whole file system and storage mechanism is not human readable the moment you get over a certain amount of documents. You know, if the software on top of it isn't working, you won't be able to find anything very easily. It makes obvious sense to structure the base data. And therefore, if you look at stuff like Notion, Confluence, Obsidian, that the basic currency of findability is still is folder structure, right? You've got tags, you've got some other clever search things, and we'll come on to AI. But ultimately, we still have fairly, not heavily structured it, but we have a well-worn, agreed-upon structure. For folders, right?
Yeah. And it's really interesting that, because I think it really sort of muddies the water in several ways, because what we're talking about there is your recall and your storing are still fairly closely linked. And that means that we've all, in our processing of knowledge, and when we go for recall, we already have as built into our heads, part of that process is how we stored it. And I think one of the promises of it, of every large-scale knowledge base, it is the separation of those two. I mean, if you think of a knowledge base which spans a company, you know, even if it was 20 or 30 people or a large team like that, you have to start separating them, because how you might store things in your file structure, which you made up on the fly whilst you had a document and you're about to store it, might be different from mine. So the more we can separate that, the better. Then we can get into it doesn't matter how you store it, because you retrieve it in a completely different way, and we can train everyone in how to retrieve, and therefore we can detach the storage side of it. So I think there's maybe that's a bit of a panacea, you know, where we want to go. But the reason again why I bring it up is because I think it does affect, like you say, you get a new tool. I mean, Notion's fairly new, only a few years old, you know, a sort of wiki base. And well, what's it got on the left-hand side? Oh, folder structure. Do you know what I mean? So, all right, now I want to find something. Well, almost built into my find mode as a person is, oh, what folder did I put in? Oh, it's over here somewhere, you know, even though we might not necessarily need that. So I think that's sort of interesting, because as we move into the AI world, if you want to call it that, driven by these large language models, one of the key things there is you can really begin to not so much separate out the storage side, but the way you access it can starts to look a lot different. And the best way I've heard it talked about is that whereas in the past you've got a document, you write a document, and when you retrieve that document, it's exactly the same. And then you can summarize it if you want. And that therefore creates a second document. With large language models, whether it was intended or not, they now have this ability to effectively make that document a living thing. So rather than, right, I've stored that document, I get it out, and then I'll read it and make a summary, you can just ask an LLM to give you a summary of the document. Now, as long as it can find it or you've given it that document, it'll produce that summary for you. So all of a sudden, there's that separation is now apparent for a slightly different reason, not because I no need to know where it is, the LLM needs to know where it is, or I need to have given it to it, but because the answer I'm getting isn't the document, it's actually the step which I really wanted, the end result which I really wanted, which was I wanted a summary of that document. And so I think that's quite interesting because it sort of introduces this separation for a slightly different reason. And as I'm sure you're going to say, is we still have to worry about how we store it, especially as technicians. But in terms of the recall, now I'm not thinking, oh, where did I put that document? Now I'm thinking, I want a summary of this information. Or that meeting I had last Tuesday with Alex, can you give me a summary of that, please? It's very different from, right, where are my meeting notes from last Tuesday? Read them and write up a summary. Do you know what I mean? And so I think the fact that these documents are now kind of living and have their own processing power built in, and we'll come to some of the downsides of those, is very, very different. You can now have two documents which can talk to each other if you like, if you want to view it that way, and combine themselves, drop certain things, and highlight the best bits of both. And they can do that without you having to go and do anything with them, supposedly. So I think that's an interesting layer that's come in.
There's quite a lot there. I as you say, it does still necessitate some way of dividing the data, especially because you're always gonna have documents with the same name, right? You might want a document with the same name. Perhaps you've got a list of a bunch of podcast episodes, and you want a folder for each, and then you want in every one of those you want a notes folder and a notes document and a draft document and a final document, right? And you don't necessarily want to think about a unique name for all of those. It's just a convenience. And you might want to summarize the draft and not the final or something, right? It matters which document's getting used as a reference. But the other thing that you graze upon there is that so one of the big problems with search as a paradigm, and Google have gone some way to solving this, is that I don't want that document. I want paragraph 15, right? I want the information from that Wikipedia page on that artist that is specifically about their artistic style, right? Which is, several scrolls down, depending on the size of the page, right? And it's really hard, unless you go for a really aggressive structuring policy with your documents, which is really hard to maintain. It's really hard to find a method for fishing out that particular bit. And so what often happens is you'll get the whole document returned, and this will be a document, about a whole bunch of things. And you're looking at this going, well, how is this relevant to me? Well, it's because that section two has some information about what you're asked about, right? So what LLMs allow you to do is not just get a summary, but say, no, just tell me what it says about X, right? And when you think about it, it's a proxy for another level of filing and classification, right? It's just saying there is a level more atomic now for for longer documents. It's not only in terms of finding buried information, but also summarizing it. And more so, that buried information might be paragraph 2, paragraph 9, paragraph 45, appendix 2. And now you can pull out not just one bit, but lots of bits from that document. And that's a big step forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And you get these really useful, trying not to use some dodgy language, but you get these really useful elements and from the LLMs. So if you're looking, you mentioned technical documents, you're looking for something like, you've got a document with 1978 in it. And a classic search will give you, like you say, every single document and paragraph with 1978, which might be a year 1978, might be a document number, might be a picture number. But with LLMs, you can say, give it to me where it's 1978 and exclude all the years. And the promise is that it actually understands that you're, and that's the language I did want to use, is understands. But because it understands some of the context and semantics around it, it will go, okay, well, I know you mean a number 1978 and not the year. So when I see a date, I'm not going to bring that up because I know that's a year. It doesn't really know, but it appears to know because of the way it works with, with context around language. So because there's a much larger understanding of the language from these models, it really feels like, it feels like there's a person in the middle. And I think that's a really good one where you go, yeah, give me that 1978. Machine goes off and gives you everything with 1978, and then you're like, no, I don't want records from that era. I want documents with that number in it. And the LLMs, these models act like a person. When you go, look, I want everything with 1978, ignore the year, please. And they go, okay, no problem. And that's your intern, right? And they give you, and there's nothing with 1978 in there, the year. And you go, great, yeah. Good work. And these have the promise. And I keep saying that the promise, and we'll come to why later, but they have that promise of doing that. And it feels like a nice jump forward. And suddenly, and you can really see why it builds excitement, because you go, what? So I can bung in a whole folder's worth of large PDFs, perhaps, 100 odd files, all the work I've done on projects over the last 4 years. I can ask a question and it'll give me what? A single phrase, a single paragraph, and the answer is, yeah, that's the promise of it. I mean, sounds unbelievable, right?
It's all very nice. But there's a bunch of counters here, right?
Yeah.
For example, why have a knowledge base at all?
Yeah.
Given that the builders of the large language models stole all your data anyway, right? So if what you're looking for is some information about the BMW cars, right, maybe you have got that already, but it's also out there on the web, right? Mm. And you can get exactly the same effect, really. And there's a level of, the way that a lot of people use large language models, particularly ChatGPT via Bing or via the app, is as a proxy for search with refinements, right?
Yeah.
So as opposed to having a, either some sort of complex Boolean search or a bunch of drop downs and refinements like you would get if you were, like you used to get in, we're still getting some shops where you're like, I want this. And then you get it. It's actually Amazon have it where you get the refinements on the left, drop it down, only give me these brands, give me these colors, yeah. And so yeah. On. And that now you can just type it in. I want a blue t-shirt with really, really short sleeves or something.
Yeah.
And you can just write it how you want it and it'll understand it. And also, to a degree, can then go and search the web sort of for you, right?
Yeah.
And get straight to the information that you need. And that's very, very powerful. But, and it seems to negate the need for a knowledge base, a sort of walled garden knowledge base,
yeah.
Right? And so the question is, why do we need a knowledge base when ultimately it's unlikely that we know too much stuff that isn't out there? Now, I'm going to say the obvious caveat, which is, very private data, and like company data, customer data, trade secrets, that type of thing, is the obvious answer to that. Mm-hmm. But also, I think there's a very good argument for like personal knowledge bases.
Yeah.
Which is ultimately, your memory is not very good, either precision or recall, right?
Yeah.
And if you're storing the things that you know, you can query the things that you know, right? Mm-hmm. And also, you can query the level of things that you know, right? Because if you're an entomologist and you say, tell me about the tortoiseshell butterfly, right? You go down the sort of the Bing, ChatGPT, Google route, you're going to get a very vanilla explanation, which is of absolutely no value, right? Whereas if you are an entomologist and you have a knowledge base, you can just ask that, right? Because you're going to get the information back that is relevant to you, and you can figure out where the holes are and then get the language model to punch at that level, right?
Yeah.
So go and get me the things I don't already know about the tortoiseshell butterfly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this is the why really. Yeah. And then things like email chains and chats and stuff that, you know, well, someone told me this last week, you know, can you tell me who, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the moment you put it in a company space, it really sort of takes off. You know, the classic one that gets talked about is sort of customer service. And if you think, you know, you produced a product, you know, perhaps you're selling a product to the company, and, you know, perhaps it's a mechanical product, you know, or, you know, chair, and someone's got to put it together themselves. You know, you've got an instruction manual for that. You know, you've got a safety sheet. Yeah, you put those things out on the web, but then people write in with questions, call in with questions. You know, you create a central knowledge base where all those questions and answers go. You know, you're not going to put that out on the web. Two reasons. You know, one, it's actually very boring. No one's interested. But obviously, as a company, you're interested, and that's your knowledge, and that's very, you know, that information could well be valuable, or I suppose importantly, valuable in the wrong hands. But it's also valuable to you because you don't want six different people in your call center getting a call for the same question over a couple of weeks and each having to go and research their own answer. You know, if you can have a layer which intercepts that, known as, you know, you might call it an agent, that goes off to your knowledge base and prompts you with the answer, then again, we're into this, you know, really great panacea world. And like you say, that then rolls all the way back to, well, someone sitting in their desk doing their job, which might not be, you know, a repetitive one, working on projects. You know, you do a certain amount as a project manager. Like you say, you've got to keep track of all the stakeholders, all the emails, all the updates, what's going on, all the actions, risk registers. If all of that is now stored and you can ask the, you know, the knowledge tool and say, oh yeah, you know, what's our risk profile been over the last, you know, 3 months? I mean, that's the same as digging out that and then looking at the spreadsheet and then maybe looking at each tab, which has got a different month on it. And then it might take you a couple of minutes. Hopefully, you know, it understands what you mean, pulls back the documents, gives you a quick summary. Oh, you know, it looks like this, and it's done in, you know, 15 seconds. But you can only do that if you are putting all of that in there. And like you say, then you're into, okay, well, you know, I wrote an email to somebody. And again, this is not a new problem. This is what people have been tackling in companies for the last 5 to 10 years with new tools, and sometimes quite aggressively from the big boys. You know, and the expanse of Microsoft Office 365 is all about this, right? It's all about all your emails and everything. And you've got projects like Basecamp, where you start a project and then any communications are done via that project layer. So those emails go into the project folder sort of automatically. You know, I know there are plugins for Office 365, so that not only is it in your personal email folder, but it's also, if you like, the property of the project. And when you close that project down and archive it, all the emails from all the people that worked on it are all there, so that, you know, if at any time in the future you want to come back and look at it, you can. But it does beg, all of a sudden, well, we've gone from, you know, talking about, oh, well, I'll make a note and drop it into, so, well, I've got some key documents. And we all know how difficult it is to actually be working on a project and to file every document, every version of the right version, and it all gets in the right place. And again, we're into that sort of folder structure issue. And now we're talking about, oh, well, what about emails? Well, what about phone calls? What about Slack messages? You know, all of a sudden, everything that everybody's using for communication, which, of course, has exploded in the last 20 years, has now... Yeah, and the good thing is it is all digital. Great, that can now be stored. And then we're into a whole world of privacy concerns. But if you did manage to get all of that in, you've now got this burgeoning, you know, enormous amount of data coming together. I'll put this layer over the top. I can ask it and get, you know, any sort of granularity I like out of it, any question.
So as a case in point, where I am at the moment, just started a new project with a company that will probably last weeks to months. And it's just sort of an analysis data strategy type thing. And the details are important. The important bit is, like any new contract or any new role, what happens when you walk in the door is you get bombarded with documents, okay, right, and information. And so, oh, yeah, so we need to rebuild this. We want to understand better what our customer's doing over here. Here's some previous research or analysis that was done. Here's a different version of that. Here's a spreadsheet that my boss likes to look at. Here's a picture of my dog, you know what I mean? It's like and it's all going in, I'm like, and then I'm on phone calls and they're going, oh yeah, but you need to put the PRC in the JBT. Ask Johnny Q about that. Right, and you're like, I don't know what any of that meant, sorry. And it's all going in, and I've got all sorts of issues with attention and retention. And for me, that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
So now it just all goes in the knowledge base, and I'm actually recording calls, transcribing them straight in the knowledge base, because I can't take notes. I can't listen and take notes at the same time. It's a real problem for me. It's a neurodiversity thing.
Yeah.
And so it all goes into this big blob, and then I can go, right, what do I know in inverted commas about X? And it'll just pull out the bits from various documents for me, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Now we should go into exactly what is doing that, right?
Yeah.
Next, but I what I will say is that I can see this rolling over to another episode.
Yeah.
Because we're getting into the how, mm-hmm. But there's a lot more to say there, and there's also the under the hood, and there's also best practices as we have seen them, right?
Yeah.
So I'm calling it now. We're going to have to roll over. So let's get our dear listeners to the point where they understand what it is that we've got, and then we'll go into details on another episode.
So just to end with the sort of, okay, well, where could this go? And like you said, I mean, I thought that example was really good. You know, you're arriving at a company and, you know, you've got the TLA is the three-letter acronym problem, which every company has. And imagine if you already had a pre-built knowledge base that kind of, you know, was, you know, sat with you, and you arrive and they go, okay, well, just install this little app, Alex, and it'll listen to calls. And when people spouting off about stuff, it'll just pop up what the acronyms mean. It'll give you a little explanation, you know, sort of, you know, it would be your little assistant. And it's, you know, introduce you to the company. Now, company is always employing new people, right? New people arrive, and as humans, we all take some time to assimilate to the job. So this is actually a really good use case for, you know, tools like this. You know, and there's a few extra layers in there. You know, like now it's listening to you. Well, we all know Alexa and Co. doing that sort of thing, and Siri. And it's this thing, and it kind of knows that you're new, so it can be sort of, you know, tuned towards new people. And then you might have another agent after you've been there for 3 months, which is slightly different. You know, CEO might have a slightly different one. But you can see, you know, and then there's, you know, start talking about agents and assistants there, you know, and this starts to layer up. So once you get the idea of a knowledge base, and I can start to natural language and liaise with that knowledge base, the more you know, and if you think about that as a person that stands between you and that, that's doing some interpretation, well, that person becomes your agent. And like all agents, if we can train them, they can become quite a sophisticated assistants for us and really start to short circuit some of the stuff that we have to do as humans. Like you say there, understanding new terms in a company, understanding, you know, and recalling stuff for us. And that's the usefulness of it. So I think they're really good use cases and the promise, and you go, is it, if we can get something like this, this is brilliant. You know, and then my next thing in my brain is I'm thinking of Jarvis in Iron Man, right? It knows what you want, a little bit sarcastic, giving you what you need just when you need it, before you think of it, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Well, you can get a sarcastic assistant now. You just put it in the system prompt, you know, be a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
And, you know, respond to everything accurately, but really sarcastically, and be a bit of a dick. And it'll do it. It'll do it very Americanly, but it'll do it. What one, like, particularly powerful use case this time around is that I'm working with a relational database, which is where most of the data is stored. Ooh. And thankfully, the main schema is, you know, full on referential integrity, foreign keys, blah, blah, blah. So the any sort of modern SQL client will show you that schema, and let you dump it out. So I dumped it out to text in so I think it was a JSON document, stuck that in the store, and then used an LLM to say, well, write me a query to get customer data with sales and you know, item bought or something, right?
Yeah.
And it, you know, it might not get it right, but it will give me the shape of the query without me having to figure out the whole schema and where all the joins and stuff are. It just figures it out. It's good at that stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
As long as you've given it enough information. And for doing what we do, especially as a contractor or a consultant, you know, that sprint start, it is where it's all at.
Yeah.
Right. Because it means you can get in there and start providing value really, really quickly.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, you know, the more I think about that use case of introduction for people, you know, the more it really pays for itself. You know, you're bringing on new people into a company. Why wouldn't you want them to be up to speed in 2 hours rather than 2 months? Do you know what I mean? I mean, that is going to give you some serious productivity payback, surely.
Well, yeah. And I don't know if we've talked about it on this before, but one of our prior clients, the analysis you did that showed the uptake time, the bedding in time for, yeah, a new consultant,
yeah,
and it's quite a lot, it's quite a long time, I can't remember what it was, before they became as productive as your average.
Oh yeah, right? Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, there's a problem right there. But I mean, we're not here to, you know, we didn't build this knowledge base to sell, but we'll round this up. So let me just describe what we have now. And it's actually very simple, right? So Obsidian is a markdown store. So stored in plain text on disk. You can, in fact, point any anything that can read markdown, could read the structure, blah, blah, blah. So I often navigate it using NeoVim. You know, Obsidian's got lots of cool tools, loads of great plugins. It's really good for fine-tuning productivity and things like that. Hotkeys, very, very configurable, and very, very extensible, extendable. And you can write your own plugins for it if you're so inclined. If you want to do JavaScript, which I never, ever, ever do, even with the help of a language model, because JavaScript is evil. But the one thing that we're There are a few AI plugins, LLM plugins, but the one that we are using quite heavily now is Copilot. The originally named Obsidian Copilot, which is essentially a sidebar app that you can sit and type queries in, like, oh, you know, just like tell me about Michael Schumacher. Don't know why he came to mind, but there you go. And it will go off and tell you what the whatever model. So you point it at GPT, Llama, or whatever the bloody Facebook one is. I can't even remember all the names. But anyway, you and you can just get normal like GPT like responses back. But you can also say, can you tell me? Here's five pages, here's five markdown pages from my store. Can you please summarize the content in these that relates to types of cheese, right? Yep. And it will go and do that for you. Now, anyone who's got any knowledge on how language models are doing things these days, that process is simply RAG, retrieval augmented generation, which means you have some sort of local process that can search your documents for cheese in this case, and do like a fuzzy search for cheese, and we'll come into vector stores in the next episode, I guess, and then send those documents or portions of those documents to the language model. And the language model and it instructs the language model to only answer with information from these documents. And so what you're really doing there is you're taking advantage of the ability of the machine to parse and respond in English or whatever language you're in, and then to produce a coherent response. What you're not using is, in this case, everything that the machine knows about, the model knows about Elvis and, microbiology or whatever, right? It's simply using the documents that you send it. You can, so Obsidian Copilot, the premium version, will do other things like search the web and then summarize the results. And you can sort of get hybrid approaches whereby, you know, you send this off, that here's the documents, use what's in here and go and find more on that, right, from the web. Mm-hmm. And I think it's Obsidian Copilot itself is still a bit alpha. It's a bit clunky, but the releases are thick and fast at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's gone from being something that was like, this is a really great idea, probably less than a year ago, a great idea, but it's just not there, to now completely relying on it and thinking there's some refinements, you know, this is going to get better and I can see the roadmap. We're not quite there yet, but it's so close.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For what I need it for.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think we'll, when we get into detail next time, we'll talk about some of the shortfalls that currently exist and probably will continue to exist, and how that might need to change people's mindsets around these tools.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of learnings as well. You sort of felt that the classic experience with the language models is you go in there and you think, oh, I can just type in, please make me a cheese and ham toasty, and it's somehow going to magically do that, right? You know, there's a lot of naivety about what they're able and supposed to do. And even being cognizant of that, trying to work one of these into your regular processes is not as straightforward as you think. And saying, well, I've got a language model, I've got a knowledge base, I can now get anything from what I want from my knowledge base and create new things from it with just a line of text. But the reality is, if you don't put in a bit of groundwork in advance, you're not going to get, you'll get results, you'll always get results, but you're not going to get good results. And you end up being a time sink rather than a time saver.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely a conversation around the things that we encountered that, allowed us to get to the point where at the moment, which in my view is about 50% to where I want to be, based on what I believe the models are capable of now.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously there's more coming down the line. And also the shift from normal models like GPT-4o to reasoning models like 1o and 4o. No, 01 and 04. Jesus, shit, I hope I get a better naming convention. And actually, some of the interesting nuances there. Plus, oh God, I could go on for hours about using. So my complementary tool for this is Warp Terminal with AI, and so it depends on how far we get in the next episode as to whether I can cover off some of that as well.
Yeah. Cool.
Let's call it a day.
Yeah.
I don't think we expected this guy to go on for two episodes.
No.
But I can actually see three, but we probably shouldn't. We should probably be disciplined. So that'll do for now, right?
Yeah, brilliant. And we'll catch up next time about it.
The confusion matrix.